Welcome back. Our next case, United States v. Cruz. Major Massey, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
Colonel Pendon, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of this court. May it please the court. My name is Major Ted Massey, and I represent appellant in this case, Corporal Tommy Cruz. Your Honor, I request 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Members of this court, the government and appellant agree that the term reported offense refers to a report of misconduct. Once a special trial counsel determined that appellant's conduct involved strangulation of his spouse, that conduct became the covered offense of domestic violence. The convening authority could not sidestep the special trial counsel's exclusive jurisdiction by repackaging that conduct, the alleged strangulation of his spouse, as an aggravated assault consummated by a battery. Here, the
can I stop you here for just a minute, Major Cruz? With the issue with the special trial counsels, the OSTICs, when the OSTIC, I like saying that, I don't know why, but when the OSTIC decides he or she is not going to go forward on the case, what are they saying? Are they saying this is not a covered offense, or this is a covered offense, but we're just not going to proceed? And maybe that's a subtle distinction, but what do you think that is?
Your Honor, what I think it is specifically is when it refers to a covered offense, the Office of Special Trial Counsel, we'll use OSTIC for example, it is determining that the underlying conduct in this case, the underlying conduct is a covered offense. So that covered offense designation attaches directly to the underlying conduct. So when deferral happens, no matter the referral decision for charges and specifications, the underlying conduct is still a covered offense.
Okay.
I think the best way to explain that is to go through the actual 24A statute to look at it, because once you look at it, so what Congress actually intended to do, Congress understood that the term offense meant conduct when it implemented Article 24 Alpha. And we know this because we look at the use of offense. Offense is within the UCMJ over 300 times, and that term is also synonymous with how it's used for the rules of court-martial.
But let's assume that that's the case.
Yes.
Let's take your position. In a situation like this, once there's a deferral, the trial counsel, special trial counsel has decided to defer prosecution. Where does that leave the convening authority? I mean, is there some indication that Congress meant the convening authority to have no decision at all, no authority in proceeding on an offense that the special trial counsel defers prosecution?
So under
From a good order and discipline standpoint, the convening authority has this case. He sends it over to the special trial counsel shop. They decide to defer, and it comes back to him saying they're not going to proceed. And he's stuck kind of with this conduct where he can't do anything with it, or can he?
Your Honor, is it okay if I use my appellant's case to explain how it works?
Oh, please.
And I'm going to start
please.
From the beginning, if that's okay.
Yes.
I'll get to your answer.
Okay. That's why I jumped the gun. I understand. I'm ready to wait.
Not all, sir. I appreciate it. So in this specific case, so we first have to look, appellant and the government agree on a lot of things. The two places we diverge is where covered offense attaches to and when. We can see where that attaches to when we look specifically at 24 Alpha. Subsection C involves duties and authorities, and then 2 under there involves determination of covered offense. A talks about authority. So here, and I'll read it, and I'm going to get to C5. A special trial counsel shall have exclusive authority to determine if a reported offense, which what we understand to be an underlying conduct of a crime, is a covered offense, and shall exercise authority over any such offense in accordance with this chapter. So in this case, what happened is allegedly appellant strangled his spouse through down the stairs. CID then made a report of this offense. The next day, special trial counsel used that part, C2A, to invoke its exclusive authority and said that the underlying conduct that was reported itself was a covered offense. And so with that, they then later deferred that
under 128B. That's important. But go ahead. Keep on.
Look, Counsel, before we get to B, they determined that the reported offense was a covered offense. It doesn't say if they determine that the underlying conduct is a covered offense. It's the reported offense is a covered offense. And strangulation would be one. But I'm having a little difficulty with this jump that you're making, that the language says if a reported offense is a covered offense. And the government's position is, well, they reported it as a strangulation, but it's not necessarily the underlying conduct. It's what was alleged, the offense that was alleged.
You're correct, Your Honor. But when you look at the UCMJ and the harmonious use of the term offense throughout the UCMJ, it really references back to an underlying conduct of a crime. It's not defined under Article 1 of the UCMJ. Only 18 things are defined. Mm-hmm. And, for example, charges and specifications isn't defined at all within the UCMJ. But we know what charges are, and we know what specifications are. We know that just because of the plain meaning of that word, and also how it's also used throughout the actual statute of the UCMJ. So when you specifically look at how offenses is used, you look at it in chapters 14 with offenses, you look at it from the beginning with like pretrial, before pretrial referral, offenses always reference an underlying conduct of a crime. And so when you look at 24 Alpha holistically and you apply the meaning of that authority that applies under 2, which involves jurisdiction, and you go through 3 and 4, and then when you get to 5 specifically, only appellant's viewpoint provides a meaning to each operative word that is used.
On that point, it's usually a when they use the word, in the UCMJ, when the word offense is used, it's usually qualified in some way, such as reported offense, covered offense, because, of course, there's only an offense if there's been a trial or a guilty plea and the evidence establishes or the plea establishes that the person is guilty of all the elements of that particular offense. I mean, there can't be an offense. That's why we have the military justice system to determine, you know, was there an offense or wasn't there an offense. A reported offense means, okay, well, it was reported. But we're not determining that there was an offense, or if it covered offense, it has to be, you know, that's a listing of the offense number. Once you start talking about the underlying conduct, I mean, that's the whole point of the court-martial, to determine whether the offense has actually occurred.
I believe Congress wanted this to attach specifically at the underlying conduct stage. That's what makes sense when you read 24 Alpha as a whole. It basically creates, I'll say this, the lower court's interpretation of this creates an absurd result. We can look directly, specifically at, I like the amicus brief of the Air Force. I think pages 16 and 17 does that absurd result justice. And I think when you look at it in a common sense term and you apply the interpretation of the lower court to basically take a specification, say conduct is reported of a sexual assault, and we happen to have a sexual assault where an accused commits a sex act on a victim. He penetrates her vulva with his penis without consent. The way that the lower court ruling reads at this point is that you could take that same exact specification, but on the charges, you change it from a 120 to a 128, and you could still move forward because it meets all the actual elements of that. So I believe...
But, counsel, isn't that happens every day, right? Well, Article 120 offenses get reduced down to a 128, often in the context of a plea agreement.
And that's exactly why appellant's interpretation works, because once it attaches to the underlying conduct, a special trial counsel can decide to move forward with the charges, and they don't have to have it be a 120, because what Congress really cared about, they wanted competent prosecutors to deal with these serious crimes.
But, counsel, then how do you, and this goes back to Judge Maggs's question somewhat, that to the extent that Article 117 enumerates specific offenses and said these are covered offenses, your argument would say any underlying conduct, essentially your argument would allow the OSTIC to expand beyond these enumerated offenses in 117.
Your I don't believe that's true because when you look at, and I'll explain, when you look at statutory interpretation, we give meaning to every operative term. So the lower court erred in its determination of how the term offense is used specifically in C. And I'll go through that in a little bit. But when we look at Article 1, Subsection 17, covered offense, it has two operative terms in there. Covered offense is defined as an offense, and then it has those punitive articles. So that term offense modifies those punitive articles to refer directly to the underlying conduct of a crime. And that, once again, supports appellant's proposition when you look at C and you understand.
Well, I guess that's the jump I don't understand, right? I don't think you disagree that conduct can be more than one offense. Just any reason, we could have some conduct, some misconduct by a service member, and it might be more than one offense, right? And those would be two offenses from the same conduct.
Yes, I agree.
Then why necessarily is conduct tied so closely to one offense? Like, why can't OSTIC decide, you know what, we're not going to go ahead with this covered offense, but there are still all these LIOs that might not be covered offenses. What in the statute would prohibit the convening authority from, if they decline, if OSTIC declines, from proceeding with these LIOs if they're not covered offenses?
You know, I want to differentiate two things in that. I know what you're getting to with the first, is that there could be other specific articles that you could charge under the UCMJ than just something that might be listed as the punitive articles in the covered offense. I get that. Congress intended for conduct to be the actual decision here because it wanted wanted special trial counsel to deal directly with these special victim crimes. So of course, a sexual assault also can involve assault consummated by a battery. But the real consideration there is what special trial counsel determines to be that conduct. So if they determine that conduct itself happens to be a covered offense, that authority is exclusive and it stays there. So when we get, for example, Your Honor, I promise I would get there, to deferral to a commander, it talks about a special trial counsel exercising their authority over an offense. Offense is an operative term that means underlying conduct of a crime. And if they decide not to prefer charges and specifications, and it goes on to say, refer charges and specifications.
But you see, you keep saying that. It refers to the underlying conduct. But it doesn't. It refers to a collection of elements that make up an offense, right? And the statute says, hey, convening authority, when this comes back to you, you can't charge a covered offense. But it doesn't say anything about charging different offenses that might be LIOs of the covered offense.
And I would say, Your Honor, with that collection of evidence, for example, in appellant's case, that evidence didn't change. You still have an alleged victim that's an intimate partner. The evidence has remained the same. This is unequivocal in this case. The only thing that changed is that the convening authority decided to charge it as an aggravated assault not consummated by a battery. This creates a legal fiction where
But how does that violate the statute? Like where does the article say he can't do that?
Your Honor, I believe with the reading of 24 Alpha as whole, that once you read, for example, C2, A, and B, of course, that talks about exclusive authority, and the exclusive authority attaches directly to the offense.
It's exclusive authority to prosecute covered offenses, but the convening authority is not prosecuting a covered offense.
But the covered offense attaches to the underlying conduct. That's the only way that the statute works.
But if it, what I am missing here in your argument and in your brief is the following. Are you saying in that instance that an accused is bulletproof if, in fact, the stick says, initially, we want to look at this in terms of what's been reported to us indicates it's a covered offense. We look at it, we defer. Are you saying that because the stick is not going to prosecute, no one can prosecute? Or are you saying something different?
I'm saying something different, Your Honor. As I mentioned earlier, I'm going to expand on this. Congress wanted competent prosecutors to...
But could you directly answer that question? You're saying the convening authority can prosecute or refer charges for that conduct, despite the fact that the stick has deferred. Initially looked at it, defers a prosecution can still take place of that accused for that conduct?
Your Honor, if the conduct itself is considered a covered offense, that the conduct, for example, say in this case, is domestic violence.
Well, I'm saying that it was reported up a covered offense, and the state says, I'm deferring. Are you saying an accused is bulletproof?
So while a secondary or third-order effects may not be to move forward, I think...
Now, you have to answer the question. You're saying, well, if the decision not to move forward, I'm asking you a very specific question.
So it's not bulletproof because the last portion of C5 specifically says, except for referral to a special or general court-martial. So there's still authority under Article 24, which is summary court-martial, and Article 15, which is NJP. Congress just did not want special victim crimes to be brought by convening authorities to a special or general court-martial.
So are you saying that the person can still be prosecuted, go to court-martial, for that conduct?
Not for a special or general court-martial.
So you're saying the most that can happen is NJP?
That's correct, Honor.
So you were referring and responding to questions by either Judge Maggs or Judge Johnson. You were talking about, well, this is the only way that the interpretation of this statutory scheme makes sense. And my question to you is, how does that make sense? That someone can engage in this type of conduct, and you're saying, can't prosecute him.
So I think Congress was concerned if a special trial counsel trained in determining...
Now, we're not getting into legislative history and so forth. What I'm interested in is the text. So where are we getting there? And when you're talking about how it makes sense, how does that make sense?
I think, Your Honor, if a special trial counsel decides that there's not enough evidence to obtain or sustain a conviction, and they have specific training for it, that it doesn't make sense that a convening authority would know it better. Because what's worse for a victim than not going to trial is to go through a trial and an acquittal.
So as defense counsel, you're concerned about what a victim was?
I'm not, of course, Your Honor. But I do believe that's the appropriate interpretation of the statute, and it's the way it makes sense to give meaning to every specific term in the statute, and also all the different sections of Article 24 Alpha.
We see counsel, so based upon that, I'm going back to your previous sentence, and this is, I think my brethren and I are all struggling with this same concept. The statute says covered offense, and so the OSTIC decides that the reported conduct, I'll use conduct, I don't want to, you know, statute says reported offense, is a covered offense. Then they make a determination, and this goes back to the initial question from Judge Sparks. Are they determining, nah, we messed up, it's really not one of the covered offenses, or are they saying this does not comport with the evidentiary standards that we have, our charging standards, so we don't want to charge it. We will defer it. So you deferred back to the commander. What Chief Judge Olson is saying is the statute only prohibits the commander from charging that covered offense. But the commander could charge known and related offenses, or as Judge Hardy noted, the commander could charge LIOs. So, again, what prohibits the commander from doing any of those three options? The commander gets it back, she gets it back from the OSTIC, and looking at the commander's authorities as set forth in 24 hours, says, okay, I can't charge one of the listed offenses in one subsection 17, but it's an LIO I can charge. It's a known or a related offense that I can charge. Why can't they do that?
Your Honor, I know I'm over my time. Ma'am, I didn't want to interrupt you.
Please respond.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And ma'am, I think it's because, as I talked about earlier, specifically when they refer to the reported offense, it refers to a report of misconduct. So the determination that a covered offense, or a report offense is a covered offense, directly attaches to that conduct. Because that authority is exclusive, That means that later on the immediate authority cannot determine that that conduct is anything but, which then precludes them from referral to a special or general court-martial.
How do we reconcile that with a lesser-included offense then?
That's because
it's the same conduct.
I believe the Air Force does a good explanation in their amicus brief, so I'll refer to that. But very briefly, it's because the LOI, the lesser-included offense, is assumed under that conduct.
So your position is that, notwithstanding the statute lists offenses within Article 1, Subsection 17, that it also will include any lesser-included offense of those offenses listed as covered offenses?
That's because I believe that the procedural determination for determining a covered offense happens at the conduct stage when special trial counsel invokes exclusive authority. It can later on say that we don't believe this is a covered offense anymore, but in the appellant's case, that's not what they did. They still determined it was a covered offense. They then deferred it, and per the statute, the committee authority should be precluded from referring to a special or general court-martial.
Any further questions from the bench?
Could I just ask one final question? Since I started this melee, at this point, let's take your case before the court now. What should have happened after the deferral? I'm the convening authority. I get this thing back. This case comes to me. Chief staff runs into me and says, hey, the OSTIC has said that they're deferring. What does the SJA tell me at that point?
So at that point, because the conduct was determined to be a covered offense, that conduct cannot be referred to a special or general court-martial. However, looking at in this case, the special trial counsel determined that there wasn't enough evidence to obtain or sustain a conviction. They did say probable cause existed. But there was other charges that were on the charge sheet, such as an MPO violation.
Well, let's pretend like, for the sake of my situation, I'm the convening authority, good old Colonel Sparks here. I never was a colonel, by the way, but that aside, comes into me, now I have this referral. Does it depend on what the actual language of the deferral is for the reasons for deferral, or is your position more general? And then the SJA comes to me and says, hey, the OSTIC has deferred colonel, general, whatever. Why don't I make myself a general? It comes to me and says, they have deferred. And I say, well, what does that mean? And what are my options? What am I supposed to do with this person? Let's say that that's the only offense before us in this case, in this scenario.
So in this scenario, it actually was the only offense. So RCM 303A, the special trial counsel is supposed to notify the convening authority that it's exercising its authority. It did it in this case. It said it was exercising under domestic violence, Article 128, Bravo. So it did it in this authority, and then it deferred it back. Now, let's say when he deferred it back, they said, we did more research. This wasn't an intimate partner, so it's assault consummated by a battery. There's nothing in the statute that says that they can't say later on that actual covered offense was not.
So let me stop you there. So sometimes it might depend on what the actual reasons for deferring back to the CAR?
That could happen. I would say so. In this specific case, they deferred back because in their letter, they specifically said there was not enough evidence to obtain or sustain a conviction. But yes, if they defer it back, it's completely within their authority to determine that we were incorrect. This isn't an intimate partner. This is just someone that he didn't know. So, of course, it's aggravated assault consummated by a battery. So they could, because it's their exclusive authority to determine if that reported conduct is itself a covered offense. So, yes, that could happen in the deferral letter, too.
So then under that scenario, isn't a non-intimate partner being handled in a better way than an intimate partner in terms of the interests of the non-intimate partner are being protected through the court-martial system, and the intimate partner, based on your analysis, is not?
So I believe by the special trial counsel evaluating if it should move forward or not, they are actually because they're specifically trained, I think they're giving a better service because they understand intimate partners. A lot of intimate partners, for example, decide they don't want to participate later on compared to a stranger. This happens all the time. These are considerations that special trial counsel have. So if an intimate partner is not wanting to move forward, how can we just think that we can actually get a conviction if that person is not even going to show up to trial?
Further questions?
No, sir.
Seeing none, thank you. Colonel Pedden.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Colonel Ian Pedden, and along with Lieutenant Matthew Parker, I represent the United States. The plain text of the statute ends the analysis in this case. Following deferral by a special trial counsel, a commander may exercise any of their authorities under the code with one narrow exception. A commander may not refer for trial by special or general court-martial a covered offense. Congress has provided a specific definition of covered offense under Article 1, which the military judge elected not to apply. Instead, the judge crafted a novel definition of covered offense using language from 24A. While only an STC may determine that a reported offense is a covered offense, neither Congress nor the President has ever said that an STC has the authority to determine a reported offense can only ever be a covered offense. This Court should therefore affirm the Court below for the following two reasons. First, because the plain text of the statute is clear. And second, because the appellant's approach would produce absurd results. This Court should apply the term covered offense the same way that Congress does, a clear list of discrete offenses that sets limits and does not expand STC authority. We can do this in a most common sense way by using a technique that's very old in military justice circles and familiar to all of us, by exceptions and substitutions. Where this Court sees the term covered offense either in the statute or elsewhere in the manual, the Court can accept the term covered offense, substituting therefore the definition that Congress provided, and so as accepted and substituted Article 24A and the exclusive authority there would read, after deferral, a commander may exercise any of the authorities under this chapter, except that such commander may not refer charges or specifications for an offense under 117 alpha, 118, 119, and so forth. Understood that way, that is the simplest, clearest, and most faithful way to apply this statute. In fact, the only place in the statute where Congress expands the list at all is to include three categories of specifically enumerated inchoate offenses, conspiracies, attempts, and solicitations under Articles 80 through 82. Notably absent, Judge Hardy, as you pointed out, Your Honor, is the inclusion of lesser included offenses, notwithstanding the fact that they're specifically provided for by Article 79. They're mentioned more than 350 times in the manual for courts martial. The term is nearly ubiquitous in criminal litigation in military and civilian appellate courts, and that term is actually in the legislative history that the appellant cites in his brief, although inserted in that history by way of amendments that were proposed and not adopted. Secondly, Congress also did not add any other authorities for the special trial counsel under Article 1. For example, not only does the article not mention LIOs, it also doesn't say that the STC has any enabling or discretionary authority to add to or modify that list in any way. It also doesn't refer to reported offense, nor did the President take any steps to modify Appendix 12A to include lesser included offenses or any modification for STC authorities there. Read that way, it's clear that neither Article 24A nor the rules for courts martial say that the determination of a special trial counsel affects the definition that Congress gave the meaning of the term covered offense in any way.
So, counsel, appellant argues that reported offense and then covered offense include the underlying conduct. So, whereas you're arguing the statute specifically sets forth covered offenses, and that's the only limitation imposed on the commander when he receives it back from a deferral, appellant argues, no, the restriction goes to the underlying conduct, and so because the underlying conduct is a covered offense, the commander is still precluded from doing anything with it. What's the government's response to that?
The government's position on that, Your Honor, is simply that that's not what the statute says. Article 1, subsection 17 is very clear and precise. had Congress intended for the determination of the special trial counsel to be binding in that way, they would have said so. I will say that in interpreting Article 24A and the exclusive authority that Congress did give to the special trial counsel there, this Court should read the statute in context set against the backdrop of the military justice system, where you do see the term reported offense, and it's important in the legal context here. You see the term both report of offense and reported offenses under RCMs 301 and 303. Those terms are longstanding in military jurisprudence, and they have They have always referred to raw data that's received at the very earliest stages of a prosecution. The discussion in RCM 301 and the modifications that the President made to it in 2023 clarify why report of offense is used in Article 24A. And again, the discussion isn't binding. It's not part of the rule, but it illuminates the context here. Subparagraph C is added to ensure special trial counsel are made aware of all allegations of covered offenses. A special trial counsel must exercise authority over a covered offense and has exclusive authority to determine whether a reported offense is a covered offense. What the President is clearly referring to here is the early stage of a prosecution where an STC must be able to intervene and exercise unified control over the investigation and disposition of a case where competing authorities could do the most harm to that case. Judge Sparks, to your question earlier, where does that leave a convening authority? It leaves the convening authority awaiting the disposition of the special trial counsel on the initial report of offense until such time as the special trial counsel defers, at which point a commander is free to do anything they ever could under the code with the exception of referral of charges that Congress set aside in Article 1.
Colonel Pitton, let me ask you this. And some of my question has to do with the fact that I'm not very familiar with how the special trial counsel does its work. But what if the deferral comes back and basically the reason is we, the special trial counsel, believe there is insufficient evidence to proceed on this covered offense? And what if that specific insufficiency goes to an element in an offense that is not a covered offense? Is the convening authority free or not to proceed with this other offense that he or she believes might still be prosecuted against the accused?
Yes, Your Honor, and for two reasons. In the first instance, because a determination by the special trial counsel with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence cannot usurp any other actor in the military justice system, whether court or commander. And secondly, because the STC's opinion with respect to offenses that are outside their purview post-deferral, let's assume for the sake of argument in your hypothetical, Your Honor, that the STC was referring to a known or related offense, as those terms are somewhat defined under the manual. If the STC were referring to a known or related offense, the opinion as to the sufficiency of evidence on those offenses would not be binding on the commander. And again, the United States position is that the sole limitation that's stated with respect to commanders in Article 24A C5 is that the commander must await the deferral by the special trial counsel, at which time they can do anything other than refer a covered offense for trial by special or general court-martial.
Counsel, I believe that the appellant counsel says that that result is absurd. Suppose we have a report of murder, and special trial counsel looks into it and concludes this is clearly self-defense. There's just no question that this was self-defense. We're not going forward. The commander then says, well, we're going to go forward with assault consummated by a battery, even though self-defense would still be the same defense, it would apply equally in both cases. It would sort of render that whole determination, as you say, well, it can't bind anybody, but doesn't that kind of make the system just kind of odd that they would make that determination? They could rule out murder. They could conclude this, you know, we're the experienced prosecutors. We know what self-defense is. There's just no self-defense here. And then the convening authority can say, well, I think I know self-defense better than special trial counsel. We're going ahead with this.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it would seem too strange at all. In the court below during oral argument, we answered a very similar question, I think from Judge Harrell, who asked if the government, following a deferral, by special trial counsel of a 118, could we charge a 128? And the answer is yes. But perhaps a counterexample that would illustrate the point and address some of what Chief Judge Olson was concerned about with regard to rendering certain accused bulletproof. Article 118 is a covered offense. Negligent homicide is not a covered offense. Does that mean that based on the judgment of a prosecutor in the special trial counsel's office that we couldn't obtain and sustain a conviction for murder, that we ought to preclude every commander from going forward on a negligent homicide? Respectfully, Your Honor, I would submit that seems slightly stranger than the possibility of the other alternative. I would also submit that should Congress find fault with that particular interpretive approach of their legislation in Article 1, subsection 17, they're certainly free to change it at any time. That's the analytical approach that this Court previously took in what I'll refer to as McPherson 2 from 2021, where this Court examined a similar statutory list, and that was an amendment to Article 43 and the statute of limitations contained in it. This Court evaluated the list that Congress included in Article 43 and elected not to stretch that statute to include conduct that wasn't covered on the list at the time. It's interesting to note that the statute of that case had the same introductory clause as the statute in this one. There, the Court noted that the term child abuse offense means. Here, Congress has said the same thing. The term covered offense means, and this Court ought to apply the introductory language there, the same way. The structure and organization of the statute also support the government's view here. For example, Congress here uses Article 1 to establish definitions for covered offenses, and Congress uses Article 24A to assign, apportion, and balance responsibilities between and among the special trial counsel and commanders. Nothing in Article 24A equates the term reported offense with the definition of covered offense or makes the STC determination with respect to a reported offense binding on a commander after deferral. I'd note, Judge Maggs, that in response to your earlier question about reported offense, the United States, I would submit, believes that you're right, that basically it means exactly what it says. It's this initial report of offense. It's important to note in that connection that the RCM 303A letter that was issued by the Special Trial Counsel's office in this case was issued less than 12 hours after the report of offense. There's no way we could know at that early stage of the proceeding exactly what happened. Rather, the term reported offense is an enabling term that authorizes the STC to exercise their authority as that's defined under RCM 103, I think, paragraph 12. And the inclusion of that term is important to the context. Lastly, I'd note in this connection that in the context, RCM 303 is the first opportunity for the President to instruct commanders on what to do with these rules. And again, Judge Sparks, to your questions, where does it leave a commander? It leaves them squarely within the ambit of a rule we have known for a very long time. In 2023, the President made one amendment to RCM 303, and it was this: except for covered offenses as defined under Article 1, subsection 17. The President specifically imported the definition that Congress provided into the rule that he uses to tell commanders what to do at those earliest stages of an investigation. And in this case, if the commander reads that rule, they should be able to turn to Article 1 and to the list of covered offenses and the inchoate offenses included and arrive at the same conclusion that this Court should hear. This Court should therefore narrowly construe Article 24A's limitations on commanders, again, with the single sole post-deferral limitation, and mindful of what the statute does not say. It doesn't say that after deferral, a commander may not refer a reported offense, a lesser included offense, or any offense which a special trial counsel has previously determined was a covered offense or exercised authority over as a covered offense. In that way, the statute is very noteworthy for what it does not say. Subject to the Court's questions on the statute, I will turn to my second point, Your Honor, which is that the appellate's interpretation of the statute here would produce absurd results. If Article 1 doesn't mean what it says and say what it means, our courts will be required in every case following deferral by an STC to develop a means by which they measure whether the exercise of STC authority somehow converted underlying conduct into a covered offense, Article 1 notwithstanding. This would be a fact-intensive inquiry that invites judicial management of prosecutorial and command functions. It would be required in every case, It would invite collateral attack on prosecutions that have already been undertaken and convictions that have already been obtained. It would also force a special trial counsel to articulate which offense or offenses are at issue, which are determined to be covered, and the gravamen of each offense, potentially attaching jurisdictional consequences to what could even be Scrivener's errors, and ironically might leave future appellants without a means effectively to challenge STC referral over an offense that, for example, is not covered. And a hypothetical here might be useful. Let's assume for the sake of argument that an STC determines that aggressive jaywalking ought to be a novel specification under Article 134, should be charged that way, and is in fact a covered offense exercising their authority under Article 24A. They refer that charge and its sole specification for trial by a special court martial, and the accused challenges the jurisdiction of the court because, as did the appellant in this case, the appellant argues that it wasn't referred to the court by competent authority. By what means would the accused plead his case? By the appellant's argument in this case, they can't look to Article 1. They have to look to Article 24A and the exclusive authority of a special trial counsel, and that simply cannot stand. And lastly, this would leave many other non-covered offenses unenforceable after deferral. I think we already talked briefly about negligent homicide, and there are others. Conduct unbecoming an officer comes to mind, and then, of course, offenses against authority, which the military judge addressed in this case, and I will also momentarily. The problems with appellant's case are rooted in the fact that his argument ignores the statute in favor of circumstance. Appellant's argument here collapses under its own weight, mostly because the circumstances in this case show that the commander properly referred the charges and specifications based on what the STC did and did not do. So here, the STC exercised exclusive authority over, quote, all covered offenses and lesser included offenses alleged in the notification, end quote. That's Appellate Exhibit 9 at page 3. The STC at Appellate Exhibit 9 at page 5 later deferred. Judge Sparks, to your question, what does a deferral mean? It means exactly what it said on the document there, that it just doesn't meet their prosecutorial standard. They may or may not be making a judgment about the quantum of admissible evidence or the likelihood that they prevail on appeal, but that's not the purpose of the document. The purpose of the document is to return authority to a commander under Article 24A, paragraph C5. Importantly, though, the STC in this case also later opined that the commander retained authority over the Article 128 offense after having been informed of the litigation in this case before the trial judge. When asked, the STC said, well, the commander retains authority over 128 because it's not a covered offense. If anything, to the extent that the RCM 303A letter was a determination that it was a covered offense, the STC's later opinion in that email indicates they determined that it wasn't. All of these errors can easily be resolved by simply applying the language in Article 1. The best example of absurd results found in the record here is how the military judge ruled on the defense motion in the first place. As to Charge 2 and its two specifications under Article 128, the military judge dismissed because the STC had determined that that was a covered offense, Article 1 notwithstanding. As to Charge 3 and its allegation of an Article 92 violation, the military judge didn't dismiss the MPO violation initially because he said that the STC had not determined that that was a covered offense. If his test was true, he could and should have stopped there, but he didn't. He went on to say that there was absolutely no evidence in the record that suggested that the appellant had violated the MPO with a specific intent to intimidate or commit a violent offense against the victim in this case. If his test is correct, and it's the STC's determination that counts, then his foray into that evidence was wholly unnecessary, even by the test that he himself devised. Most notable in how the military judge ruled on the motion to dismiss in this case is the fact that he doesn't address Charge 1 at all. The face of the document, the charging instrument, specifically alleges that the accused was drunk and disorderly on the exact same night as the assault in this case. If anything, that ought to have put the judge on notice, and with deference and respect to his judgment, and I do respect him, it ought to have put him on notice that he should have examined the gravamen of that offense, too. Now, it's clear that the remainder of the allied papers weren't before the military judge in this case when he ruled on that motion, but they are before this court here. And the allied papers in this case show that the Article 32 preliminary hearing officer found probable cause for the drunken disorderly specification, based on disorderly conduct where the substance of the disorder was the accused strangling his wife, hitting his wife, and pushing her down the stairs. Your Honor, the United States is less concerned about whether the judge visited those facts than the United States is concerned by the fact that every judge moving forward would have to do the same, to examine all evidence everywhere instead of just applying Article 1. Article 1 must mean what it says, and it must carry the same meaning for courts, for counsel, and for commanders. And, Your Honor, for those reasons, the United States respectfully requests this court affirm the judgment of the court below, subject to your questions.
Other questions? Thank you, Colonel Penn. Major Massey.
Your Honors, there's a few points I would like to make. Judge Sparks, I didn't answer your question directly in regards to the deferral letter and if it matters. The answer is yes, it does matter. In this specific deferral letter, the special trial counsel did say that there was probable cause, but not enough evidence to obtain and sustain a conviction. They did not say that this still was not a covered offense. As in regards to an absurd result, if you rule in the favor of appellant, it would not create an absurd result. Jurisdiction is always a question within this court, and it would still remain a question if you're ruling in appellant's favor. All that would occur is that motions practice would just have to happen at the trial result. It's the exclusive authority of a special trial counsel to determine that a covered offense, that reported offense is a covered offense. Simple enough, you could look at the 303A letter and you could look at what conduct they determined to be a covered offense. If anything, appellant's case is a perfect example to show how the ruling of the lower court created an absurd result because it flies in the face of what Congress was trying to accomplish. Congress wanted specialized prosecutors to deal with the most serious crimes. Nothing in this case changed. When the convening authority charged appellant with aggravated assault consummated by a battery, there was still a special victim in this case. The evidence remained the same. All they did is change the charges on the charge sheet. And that is an absurd result.
Counsel, can you address the last point that the government counsel made about the drunk and disorderly charge? Wasn't that just based on the same underlying conduct that was at issue in the reported offense of strangulation? I gather the government's point is if that's the test, well, then you couldn't send it back and try the person for drunken disorderly conduct either.
That's a different conduct, Your Honor, I would say, because when we take a look specifically at the report that was made by CAD, that report specifically, and this is what the trial counsel told that judge, was involved at what happened at home in that night. There was no discussion within that conduct that was reported of drunk driving. That happened separate and apart of the conduct that happened with the alleged domestic violence. Thus, you see the system actually works because to claim known and related offenses is discretionary for the special trial counsel. They never claimed the known and related offenses for that one. Thus, the convening authority could move forward on charging charge one because of the fact that that was a different conduct.
Well, let's talk about a different hypothetical. What about you have some conduct? I think we agreed earlier that one act of misconduct could be two offenses under the code. And we have that in a situation. And one is a covered offense, and one is not a covered offense. And it goes up to OSTIC, and they decline to proceed, and it goes back to the commander and the convening authority. What about, let's just say you're right about the covered offense and any LIOs of that offense, but what about the other non-covered offense? Could the convening authority proceed with it, even though it comes from the exact same conduct, which led to both the covered offense and the non-covered offense?
If the conduct was a covered offense, then Congress wanted specifically only for special trial counsel to deal with that because it involves a special victim. And so once that gets deferred back per subsection 5, deferral to a commanding officer, what they can do is they can take any action or authority except refer to a special general court-martial for that covered conduct, Your Honor.
So your theory does run then to any offenses, covered or non-covered offenses, that arise out of that conduct, the conduct that led to the covered offense?
Correct, Your Honor. When the conduct is determined and the underlying conduct is determined to be a covered offense, then the convening authority is precluded from referring that because that conduct, the special trial counsel has exclusive authority to determine that conduct itself is a covered offense.
But, Your Honor, counsel, the language of the statute does not, because, see, you just said that the convening authority could not refer the underlying conduct. That's not the language of the statute. The statute says, may not refer charges and specifications for a covered offense for trial by special or general court-martial, a covered offense, which is delineated in Articles 1, subsection 17. So, this is the whole issue. When the statute talks about covered offenses, that's a term of art within the special victim realm, and we must look back to Article 1, subsection 17, and say, hey, is this one of the things that is listed? If it's not listed, it's not a covered offense.
Your Honor, I know I'm over my time.
Please respond to Judge Johnson.
Thank you. When we look at earlier within that specific section, it talks directly about charging specifications to an offense. When it uses the terminology offense, it's referring to underlying conduct that could either be a covered offense or known or related offense.
Yes, but the restriction on the commander specifically uses the terminology covered offense.
Correct, and that's because when you do look at the definition and you were to use the terminology of each word, it refers directly to an offense, which is covered conduct of the punitive articles. So it's harmonious and it supports specifically the proposition that it's referring to the underlying conduct, which is different than the charging specifications made. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Do you wish to briefly conclude?
Your Honor, for those reasons, I believe that the committing authority lacked exclusive jurisdiction, and for those reasons, you should rule for the military judge and dismiss charge 2. Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.